Admiral Conan Antonio Motti said. His gaze swung over the room. He took in the screens Tag had been examining, and although he said nothing, the sneer on his face indicated his dismissal of Tag's concerns.
"Let's go," Tag said gruffly.
The two men didn't talk as they strode down the corridor to the Joint Chiefs' meeting room. A few of the senior officers were already seated, chatting among themselves. Idle conversations. Meaningless words. Tag took his seat without speaking, a scowl growing on his face. These men were old. They'd had their war, and they believed they'd ended all war with the finality of it. They leaned in their chairs, comfortable, firm in the safety of the battle station around them. Tag swore to himself that he would never slip into passivity like that. He would inevitably grow old and gray like the senior chiefs. He would have his wars behind him as they did. But he would never lean back in his chair and sip his calf and ignore the looming threat merely because he didn't want to believe it to be there.
"Is something wrong?"
one of the senior advisors asked at Tag's scowl. Before he could answer, Motti burst in.
"He's being paranoid," he said in a dismissive tone.
Tag swallowed down his anger, but he couldn't help but insist on the truth.
"Until this battle station is fully operational, we are vulnerable."
He caught a glimpse of Motti's gleam of triumph for having successfully baited him, but he continued anyway. "The Rebel Alliance is too well equipped. They're more dangerous than you realize."
"Dangerous to your Starfleet, Commander, not to this battle station."
Motti was so quick to respond that Tag was certain he'd been crafting this comeback since he stopped by the tactical room. Tag cast a surreptitious look around the room. The senior advisors clearly agreed with Motti. They were comfortable, Tag realized, made lenient by the protection they felt inside the Dunium walls. Soft. Weak. Unwilling to see that the large round laser at the heart of the Death Star was just as easily a target as a weapon. An image of Director Orson Krennic flashed in Tag's mind, and he had to resist the urge to look at the seat the man had once occupied in this very room. He thought of the enraged way the director had insisted the Death Star was ready, that it would revolutionize the galaxy and quell even the most fleeting thought of rebellion.
"Would it take the veins popping out of my neck, spittle flying from my lips, a crazed look in my eye before these men would listen?" Tag thought.
And then he remembered Krennic's fate and thought,
was that what happened to men who argued in this room? Still, he needed them to see, to understand.
"The rebellion will continue to gain support in the Imperial Senate until..."
Grand Moff Willef Tarkin strode into the room, and Tag's words died in his throat.
"The Imperial Senate will no longer be of any concern to us. I have just received word that the Emperor has dissolved the Council permanently. The last remnants of the Republic have been swept away."
A sliver of ice ran down Tag's back. "No Senate?" he thought. He imagined the hive ants, each in individual jars, and then he imagined the lids on each of them disappearing, and the swarm rising up.
"That's impossible!" Tag exclaimed. "How will the Emperor maintain control without the bureaucracy?"
He caught a disapproving look from one of the senior advisors, but he disregarded it. It wasn't weapons that kept people obedient, despite what Motti, what Krennic, what Tarkin himself believed. Weapons riled people up, reminded them that they could fight. It was bureaucratic mediocrity that made them accept their fate. Show a man a blaster, and he looked for a way to take it for himself and turn it on you. Tell a man he can fight in court, and 9 times out of 10, he'll disappear just to avoid the tediousness.
"The regional governors will now have direct control over their territories," Tarkin continued, his voice almost idle. "Fear will keep the system in line."
He shot a quick glance at Tag.
"Fear of this battle station,"
he continued, speaking to the rest of the group. Tag ignored the subtle dig and the way Motti reveled in it.
"And what of the rebellion?" he insisted. "If the rebels have obtained a complete technical readout of this station, it is possible, however unlikely, that they might find a weakness and exploit it."
Tag had intended Tarkin to answer him, Instead, the gravelly, deep voice of Lord Vader filled the room.
The plans you refer to will soon be back in our hands.
Tag thought for a moment that he heard the sounds of distant screams and shouting, the clatter of a battle in a small area, the swish of a weapon he didn't recognize. But before his brain could fully process the phantom sounds, they were gone. When he looked up, Lord Vader faced him. Not for the first time, Tag wondered what was behind the mask, and then he questioned whether he truly wanted to know. He ground his teeth, unwilling to show the way Lord Vader's gaze intimidated him. He didn't breathe until the black-suited lord shifted his attention to Mahti. He watched dispassionately as they exchanged words, as Vader strolled from behind Tarkin toward Mahti. The tension crackled as Mahti's anger flared. Vader raised his hand. Mahti's words stuttered to nothing but gasping breaths, desperate for air. Mahti had called Vader's beliefs ancient and sorcerous, and Tag couldn't help but agree. Nothing but wizardry could have made Mahti choke while Vader, meters away, merely raised his hands and squeezed. Tag couldn't help but bring his own hand to his mouth, but he knew better than to speak. The men around the table watched as Mahti struggled to breathe until Tarkin, seemingly bored, ordered his release. Tag glanced at the chair two down from his. Then his eyes met Mahdi's. A thin sheen of sweat dotted Mahdi's brow, his eyes still bulging slightly from the choking. But he didn't say anything further, and neither did Tag. His data had been wrong. He knew that now. Tag had looked at the angles incorrectly, surmised the outcomes based on incomplete data. He had assumed the Empire's greatest weapon was the Death Star. But he was beginning to realize that it might just be Lord Vader himself.
An Incident Report by Mallory Ortberg. It didn't make him right, you know. It made him angry, it made him violent, but it didn't make him right. You may or may not have already reviewed the footage. It's my opinion that attempted murder at a meeting of the Joint Chiefs of the Galactic Empire merits a thorough, personal investigation by the members of High Command. But you gentlemen will, of course, act as you see fit. The point is, whatever conclusions you ultimately draw about the incident taking place between myself and Lord Vader during yesterday morning's briefing, he was wrong. And trying to crush someone else's windpipe doesn't make you any less wrong, if you're wrong to begin with. Which he was. I do not concede the argument. I submit myself willingly to discipline if I am in error. But I believe I am correct in saying that I have been appointed the Chief of the Imperial Navy. I believe I am also correct in stating that the Imperial Navy is a military organization, that its goals and aims are martial in nature, that we seek to both engage in armed hostilities and to ultimately win them, and that therefore we have every right to place the majority of our hopes on the technological marvel that is this battle station, and that I was not out of line to suggest that said battle station is both a technological marvel and the pride of the Imperial Navy, and that we would be well served to put it to use as quickly and as often as necessary, if not as possible. I wish to take this opportunity to point out that I have no objection to the gentleman's religious beliefs, nor do I object to the prospect of working with Lord Vader again in future, assuming the Empire is willing to take all necessary precautions to ensure public safety, and with Lord Vader's personal guarantee that he will confine himself to using words to win arguments in future, as befits a ranking member of the Imperial Council, and save acts of out-and-out violence from members of the Rebel Alliance. I can assure you, gentlemen, that I have no interest in holding grudges, nor in recreating the type of petty feuds of all too recent memory that characterized the day-to-day operations of the Imperial Senate. Moreover, I am not a bigot. It is a point of pride with me that in my native sector of Sesuena, there are over 300 distinct religious traditions with active practitioners, all officially recognized by their imperial administrator. I myself am a man of faith, as it happens, and believe that imperial unity can only be strengthened through cooperative and constructive dialogue among citizens following diverse spiritual traditions. I would welcome, under more appropriate circumstances, the opportunity to learn more about Lord Vader's understanding of the Force and how it enriches his daily life. I do not welcome Lord Vader quite literally attempting to shove his religious beliefs down my throat. This was a military meeting at a military installation attended exclusively by military personnel. I will not apologize for asking Lord Vader to refrain from commandeering the conversation into a referendum on his religious devotion. Nor will I apologize for attempting to give credit to the hard-working men, women, and neutrois whose years of dedication made this day possible by praising the capabilities of the Death Star Station. It is my belief that effective managers should offer at least as much praise as they do criticism. At any rate, if you've reviewed the footage, which I strongly encourage you to do, you'll notice two things. The first and most critical to my argument is that Lord Vader expressed open contempt for the Death Star Project in front of his subordinates, many of whom have dedicated their lives to seeing the station completed. It was, to put it mildly, a speech that undermined public faith in both the Galactic Empire's vision and its competency. The Empire has invested over 20 years, countless man hours, and over 1 trillion credits in the development of the Death Star. I need hardly remind you, gentlemen, that it cannot possibly serve any of our aims to have a member of the Joint Chiefs blatantly disparaging the most ambitious and expensive military venture in recent history. He has had more than 2 decades to express any relevant concerns to our engineering and development teams, and has always been free to make whatever suggestions he deems necessary about the creation of a Force-sensitive unit to either Grand Moff Tarkin or the Emperor himself. The day we are set to launch the most ambitious military project in Imperial history is not the time. In front of the first joint meeting of Imperial governors and Rear Admirals is not the place. I quote directly from Lord Vader moments before he assaulted me. Don't be too proud of this technological terror you've constructed. The ability to destroy a planet is insignificant next to the power of the Force. It should go without saying, gentlemen, that I am perfectly accustomed to a little briefing room brawling every now and then. I am a military man. I am not asking for pity. I am perfectly well. I am not asking for special treatment. I mean to say, don't be too proud of the Death Star? Of the battle station we are currently holding a meeting in? Upon which the Emperor himself has pinned his greatest hopes? Is this how the Imperial leadership hopes to inspire our troops? Ask them to dedicate their careers and lives to technological innovation, only to tell them not to be too proud when their labors finally come to fruition? Have I missed an official change in policy? I will not apologize for taking pride in my work, nor for encouraging my employees to take pride in theirs. If the Empire wishes to reprimand me for this, so be it. This felt frankly like an act of workplace proselytization. Again, I have no objection whatever to Lord Vader's private faith. It must, however, be pointed out that at present, the number of planets destroyed solely by the unaided power of the Force is 0. The number of planets destroyed by the power of the Death Star is 1. The number of days the Death Star has been fully operational is also 1. The second thing you will notice, gentlemen, while watching the tape, is that Lord Vader is forced to take several steps in my direction before, to use a colloquialism and for lack of a more accurate term, force-choking me. For all his claims that the power of the Force is greater than the destructive capabilities of this Death Star, it strikes me as more than a little disingenuous if he cannot even remotely choke a single individual from across the room. I imagine Lord Vader would have had to stand very close to the planet Alderaan, indeed today, if he had wanted to demonstrate how thoroughly his Force-wielding abilities outmatched the Death Star. But I digress. I am here to give an account of the events that transpired in yesterday's briefing, and to submit myself for possible correction, nothing more. We were in the main conference room on the officer's deck. Vice Admiral Talatz, Rear Admiral Tian Gergerod, Kendall Ozzel, Commander Cassio Tag, Admiral Niels Tennant, and myself, discussing the relative threat levels facing our respective commands. Commander Tag was, in my opinion, distressingly myopic on the subject of the Rebel Alliance. Although I commend him for his concern for the well-being of his own troops, the threat posed by a patchwork fleet of second-hand X- and Y-wing starfighters, led by a complement of informally trained pilots, is, in my opinion, minimal. That is not to say that there is not a time or a place for discussing the Rebel threat. No one ever won a war through overconfidence, merely that Tag's concerns are not universal. The dog nipping at his heels in the street is no threat to my locked and guarded house, so to speak. At this point, we were joined by Grand Moff Tarkin and Lord Vader, who informed us that the Imperial Senate had been formally and permanently dissolved by the Emperor. May I take this opportunity to say, I think this action was a long time in coming and can only benefit us as an organization moving forward. Tag, who only moments before had feared that rebel support within the Senate would destroy us, now feared the opposite. Namely, that without the apparatus of the state bureaucracy, the Emperor would be unable to maintain order. I would like to say personally that I do not believe the Emperor requires any such assistance, and that Tag's repeated questioning of the Emperor's actions, if not outright treasonous, at the very least bespeaks a lack of fitness for command. Perhaps once the High Command has finished investigating Lord Vader's outburst, it will turn its attention to Tag's competence, loyalty, and overall value to our organization. It was then that I dismissed Tag and Vader's line of argument, namely that the rebellion, if in possession of the Death Star blueprints, might pose an immediate threat to our safety, by pointing out that merely obtaining technical data was not the same thing as an imminent assault. There are blueprints of every single Star Destroyer, Governor's Mansion, Imperial Palace, and Naval Shipyard in the Empire. And most of them have backups kept in various data storage facilities throughout the galaxy. Does Tag mean to suggest that the mere existence of the artifacts necessary to the architectural process poses an existential threat? We have, I might add, an entire military intelligence unit whose sole job it is to evaluate the credibility of possible threats. I then encouraged the other admirals that, having invested so much time and energy into building the Death Star, it might perhaps behoove us to use it. I need hardly to say to you, gentlemen, that this was merely restating the official Tarkin doctrine. It is scarcely in dispute. If the rebels launch an attack, we will defend ourselves. In the meantime, I believe we should continue to employ every method at our disposal to ending the war. The rest, you know. Lord Vader, for some reason, took issue with my idea that we used the weapon we had only recently finished building, suggested that we take less pride in our military achievements as an organization, and once again loudly evangelized his specific religious beliefs. I may have been heated in my response, but I merely spoke the truth. Lord Vader's devotion to a nearly extinct faith has not resulted in the recovery of the stolen data tapes, nor has it given him insight into the rebel's secret base, nor has he ever destroyed a planet. His response was showy and attention-grabbing, certainly, but he could not refute a single one of my arguments. He found my lack of faith disturbing. I have never claimed to be an adherent to his sect. I found his lack of faith in this military installation disturbing. I do not attend Lord Vader's religious ceremonies and demand he venerate the Death Star's architectural staff. I ask him to refrain from interrupting my meetings and insisting I kowtow before this force of his. I also, as I stated before, object to his choking me. I concede nothing. I maintain, as I always have, that if we were going to build the Death Star, we might as well use it. It should please the members of High Command to note that I am at the present moment able to confirm that this battle station is in fact fully operational and has thus far exceeded every hope we have ever placed in its construction. I have no doubt the Emperor will be gratified to hear this. I myself initiated the firing sequence upon Grand Moff Tarkin's command. Lord Vader himself can confirm this if you care to ask him. I might add that the planet Alderaan was selected, targeted, and destroyed, all without the aid of Lord Vader's precious force. Thanks entirely to the competence, diligence, and efficiency of the Death Star operations team. I have no further comment on the matter.
Change of Heart by Elizabeth Wien. The hardest part about the work was keeping your feelings under control. You couldn't afford to show discomfort, even if the light was too bright. You were trained to mask your physical response to pain, to fear, to surprise, to anything. Not just in your face, but in your entire body. You took pride in it, too. On guard, you had to be as smooth-faced and immobile as a droid. And Lord Vader would always know if you faltered. If you twitched a finger or even an eyebrow. Even if he wasn't looking at you. It was easier being in the faceless, armored ranks of the stormtroopers, where no one could see your twitching eyebrow beneath the hard white mask. Being here, at Vader's side, flanking him, a meter ahead of him or a meter behind, in pace with a partner whose name you didn't know and with whom you'd never exchanged a spoken word, was an honor and a privilege. Your face was uncovered. Your mask was invisible. You were in the inner circle. Everyone knew you were ambitious. You wouldn't be here otherwise, but you could never show it. You couldn't show anything. You saw things. You learned things. You knew things that no one but Lord Vader himself knew. This was why you joined. This was what you'd come for, what you'd thirsted for. To be here, on the cutting edge of military technology. To be among the first watch to witness the galaxy yielding up its treasures and its secrets to the ever-expanding galactic empire. And here you were, aboard the mightiest battle station the galaxy had ever seen, at the side of the Emperor's most feared and powerful strategist. And yet, sometimes it still took all your concentration to keep your mouth set and your brow straight. You walked ahead of Vader, on his right, as he strode through the sterile corridors of the detention block. You and your silent counterpart had to set the pace for him, while keeping in perfect step with each other. A challenging and often daunting game of skill. On this occasion, though, after Vader had keyed in the codes to open the door to the unlucky prisoner he was about to interrogate, he stepped into the cell ahead of you. There was no invitation to follow, but, of course, you did it automatically. This was exactly the kind of moment you hated. No matter how hard you'd trained for it, you never stopped hating being taken by surprise. The prisoner was a young girl. It came as a shock. You'd known Princess Leia Organa of Alderaan was a member of the Galactic Senate, but you hadn't realized she'd be so young. And never in a million years had it occurred to you to expect such winning beauty. small-boned, neat, round-faced, still wearing the formal white gown of a diplomat, and with her long, dark hair still smoothly rolled around her head in formal elegance, she sat straight and defiant against the smooth, cold wall of her cell. But this work had made you good at reading faces, and it took only a glance for you to see that she was terrified. She was controlling it, but not well. Her dark eyes were wide and frightened, and she was cringing backward into the corner of the cell, bracing herself as Vader approached. All this hit you in the second it took to enter the small room. Lord Vader loomed tall and menacing over the cowering girl. But you kept your face still. You were better at it than she was. "Don't look at her," you reminded yourself. "Don't catch her eye." The single unit that you made with your counterpart was split as you stepped aside, one of you on each side of the door, so that the menacing black globe of the interrogator droid could drift in. You didn't blink as it hovered less than an arm's length from your head, the mind probe hypodermic poised dangerously close to your own eye. It wasn't here for you. The girl's dark eyes widened when she saw it. She gave a little gasp of apprehension. Vader said to her,
"And now, Your Highness, we will discuss the location of your hidden rebel base."
And the cell door glided smoothly shut behind you, sealing all four of you in together. The crowded cell was never designed to hold so many. You stood rigid and passive, and thought of the command you'd someday have. You had to watch. There was no choice but to watch. But you weren't going to let yourself think of anything else but your own bright future. It didn't work. You were undone with shock at how much of yourself you recognized in this fragile, fearful, defiant young rebel with a backbone of steel. You could see as surely as Vader himself could that the girl knew more than she was revealing. She resisted and battled against the intrusion into her mind, but showed none of the confusion or outrage you'd expect from someone who had nothing to hide. She knew why she was here, and, just like you, she was focused on endurance, on holding herself in. Her entire being was centered on not letting Darth Vader see what was going on in her head. She was exactly like you. When the heavy door slid open again, and the exhausting session had come to its temporary close, the girl was left on her own again, wrung out in a quivering heap of emotional and physical collapse. But unlike her, you weren't allowed the luxury of either emotion or collapse. She'd still given up nothing when Governor Tarkin sent for her. Her hands were manacled as you marched her through the Death Star's labyrinthine corridors. She was composed again, though. It wasn't obvious that she was scurrying to keep up. The base Vader set was hard for her small frame to match. She still looked the part of a young ambassador on a diplomatic mission, and she was still playing that role with steely composure, just as you were playing your own role. You felt it as a shock in the pit of your stomach when you realized that she was matching your stride. You were shorter than your counterpart by a couple of fingers, and she was measuring her steps against yours to help her maintain her dignity. You stared straight ahead, expressionless as always. You were not helping her. You felt your composure slipping, even though your expression didn't change. If Vader weren't so focused on the prisoner, would he look at you and guess? "Focus," you told yourself fiercely. "Focus!" You forced your hard soles to strike the shining decking of the corridor in perfect time with those of your counterpart. You pretended you couldn't hear the pattering footfalls of the girl's soft white boots exactly matching your own steps. Governor Tarkin was waiting in the overbridge with Admiral Motti. Beyond the plating of the broad curved viewport was a black canvas of starlight and the blue glow of the planet Alderaan floating serenely against its backdrop. You and your counterpart fell back to take your expected positions in deference to the commanders present, and Vader halted. But the undaunted girl swept forward, majestically, to take on Tarkin herself. She was formal and snide. She told him he stank. Vader stepped behind her, looming over her with all the menace of his full height. The top of her head only came to his breastplate. He laid one heavy gloved hand in warning against her back, reminding her she was still his prisoner. As if it were possible for her to forget, here in the control room of the Death Star, surrounded by enemies and guards with her hands bound. From where you stood behind the girl and Vader, you couldn't see her face, but you could see Tarkin's wry grin as he took her chin in his hand and told her he had signed the order for her execution. Again, for a moment, your stomach plummeted in cold shock. But you didn't swallow. You didn't even blink. She didn't flinch either. She answered Tarkin, still icily formal. "I'm surprised you had the courage to take the responsibility yourself." Tarkin didn't rise to her high-brow baiting. Instead, he stepped away from her. Coolly, he invited her to watch the first ceremonial demonstration of the Death Star's capabilities.
"No star system will dare oppose the Emperor now," he taunted her.
You were now so invested in her defiance that you'd forgotten you weren't supposed to be listening. Your feigned indifference was trained. It came automatically. But the girl had no such training. She didn't realize how Tarkin was playing her. She was unaware he'd taken over her interrogation. And already he was succeeding at stripping information out of her that neither Lord Vader nor the interrogator droid had been able to. Tarkin was forcing her into declaring her loyalty. She was so angry and defiant and scared that she didn't even realize she was doing it. Her speech was tight and clipped as she gave herself away, her voice full of pride and hatred. "The more you tighten your grip, Tarkin, the more star systems will slip through your fingers." He was sure of her now. She'd as much as admitted her loyalty to the rebellion. He turned away from her and stared out at the blue glowing orb of the planet in the near distance. He said,
"I have chosen to test this station's destructive power on your home planet of Alderaan."
And she broke. You did not, but she did.
"No!"
She leapt forward, entreating him, no longer taking care with how she shaped her words.
"Alderaan is peaceful. We have no weapons."
He turned around abruptly. She was still crying out in protest.
"You can't possibly..."
He cut her short, speaking over her exclamation.
"You will provide another target, a military target, then name the system."
This was, in its way, more painful to witness than the physical torment the young princess had borne with such fierce determination as Vader had probed her mind beneath the hungry needles of the interrogator droid. Tarkin had unmasked her. The steel was gone. She was frightened and desperate. But still she hesitated, still unwilling to answer his question. And now Tarkin, too, was on the edge of coming unmasked. There was cold anger in his voice as he confronted her.
"I grow tired of asking this."
The girl recoiled from his fury and backed straight into Lord Vader.
"So it'll be the last time."
She flinched at last. She bent her head away from Tarkin's, then forced herself to look directly at him again as he demanded,
"Where is the rebel base?"
Her small body was trapped between Governor Tarkin and Lord Vader. All you could see was the back of her elegant, shining head. But you could tell she wasn't looking at Tarkin now. She was staring over his shoulder at the beautiful blue planet, floating beyond the wide viewing panel. The planet that was her home. There was a strange, quiet moment in which time seemed to stand still. A pause in which the young girl thought hard and fast about who she was going to betray.
"Dantooine,"
she said in defeat, still staring over Tarkin's shoulder. You saw Tarkin's grim, triumphant smile. After another moment, the girl looked up at him. And then, almost immediately, as if she couldn't bear the victory in his eyes, she lowered her head. You still couldn't see her face, and now neither could Tarkin. She repeated unsteadily,
"They're on Dantooine."
She was lying through her teeth. Governor Tarkin spoke to Lord Vader over the smooth crown of the princess's lowered head.
"There."
Tarkin stepped away from his menacing position in front of the bound and cowering girl, and for just a split second he came toward you, standing motionless behind Lord Vader. In that fraction of a second, you thought that he knew it too, that he'd seen her lie, and that he was looking to you for confirmation. But he wasn't seeing you as anything other than the silent fixture that you always were in his presence. And in another fraction of a second, he'd stepped away and added,
"You see, Lord Vader, she can be reasonable."
You stood unbroken, not moving, not blinking, but your entire inner being was quivering in disbelief. He didn't see it. She was lying through her teeth, and her interrogator didn't see it. Vader didn't see it. No one saw it but you. The training held you still. The training controlled your body, but your mind raced with turmoil. Should you say something? Is it a trick to test your own loyalty? Has someone seen through your soaring ambition? Guessed at the hierarchy you'd like to penetrate? The command post you thirst for? What will you gain by speaking out against her? Will it show keen perception? Your ability to know a prisoner's thoughts? Your own untapped potential as an interrogator? No. Through the storm of uncertainty, you knew you were no latent interrogator. You didn't have Tarkin's skill or Vader's power. You weren't reading the girl's mind. It was simpler than that. You knew she was lying because it was exactly what you would do.
"Continue with the operation,"
Tarkin gave the order offhandedly to Admiral Mati.
"You may fire when ready."
"What?"
the princess cried out. There was a scuffle. Tarkin, reverting to his dry and formal self, told her,
"You're far too trusting."
The princess leapt forward, as if she could somehow stop him or attack him, bound as she was. But Lord Vader seized her by her shoulder and pulled her back against the hard casing of his hulking breastplate. He held her helpless there and forced her to watch. No one forced you, but you and your silent counterpart stood facing the view of the doomed blue world. And just as in the prison cell earlier, you had no choice but to watch. You're far too trusting. She wasn't trusting, you realized. She might be broken, and she might be under the threat of execution, but she still hadn't given anything away. Even to save her world. The destruction of Alderaan was blinding. There was no noise in the control room of the Death Star. All the company watched, hushed, as the terrible brightness flared around them. You could have betrayed her now. Whenever they inevitably sent their scouts and probes to Dantooine, you knew for certain they would find nothing there. You could have spared them the effort, the expense, the wasted power. You could have been rewarded for it. But doubt bloomed in your heart, and you hesitated. You're far too trusting, There was no reason Governor Tarkin would ever reward you. Why not betray her, though? Why not call out her falseness just because you were a loyal Imperial Guard? The brightness burned your eyes. You dared not blink. You stood still and said nothing, momentarily blinded. You would not betray her. Your spirit was shaken, and your loyalty changed. Your silence made you her ally. You were now as doomed as she was. You would never betray her. You had joined her rebellion.
Eclipse by Madeline Rue. Bria Organa watched the slanted sunbeam behind Visea's shoulder. The light in the gallery above the palace's grand entrance hall grew gold and then orange, signaling the end of the afternoon. Another day without her husband and daughter was coming to a close, but it had passed as slowly as a lifetime. Visea spoke just as slowly, methodically reminding the queen of her schedule for the remainder of the day. With each word, each then, followed by another chore, another meeting, another duty, Bria became wearier and wearier. A tight wrinkle formed between her eyes as she watched that one solitary sunbeam. It had sneaked in through one of the high windows above them, a single splash of gold amid the silvery blue splendor of the palace. Even when she was a child, the hall had reminded her of the inside of a seashell, smooth and lustrous, always slightly cool even at the height of summer.
Then you are expected to found a school for underprivileged nerfs who just want to follow their dreams and become dancers.
Bria snapped her gaze away from the sunbeam, looking in startled bemusement at the middle-aged woman beside her. As an advisor, Visea was so important to her that Bria often joked that losing her would be like cutting off a hand. She had even had matching rings made for them, simple little silver bands they each wore on their right index fingers. "Perhaps I am a bit distracted," Bria admitted, passing a soothing hand over her face. "Cancel my appointments for the rest of the day, please. My mind is simply elsewhere." Visea nodded, consulting her datapad with renewed determination.
"Of course. Easily done."
Then she paused, and Bria might have lost interest again and let her mind wander. But something in the woman's face made her watchful. Visea never demonstrated concern, always maintaining a mask of relaxed confidence. But now her dark brows were drawn in, furrowed, her foot tapping under her gown, rippling the silk. "There is still no word," Bria told her, reaching out to touch the woman's wrist. It was an overly familiar gesture, perhaps, but these were unusual times. "Captain Andoram has asked me to stop raising him in the spaceport. He swears I will be the first to know when his shuttle lands." Visea did not look at all relieved.
"I could go and keep watch. I don't mind."
Bria smiled gently. "Captain Andoram insisted. He is not to be bothered again today."
"Oh, but he only requested that you stop asking for him. I was issued no such warning."
And this was why Visea was her right hand. Bria was not above admitting to herself that without help, she would not have weathered the recent storm. The dissolution of the Senate had come as such a blow, turning every incoming piece of news into possible calamity. The Empire was far beyond subtle politicking now. They were desperate to crush the rebellion, and desperate animals were always the most dangerous. Bria pressed her lips together briefly and then nodded once.
"Be discreet, and thank you. Now I think I will retire. I never knew I could be this exhausted."
Visea made her curtsy and bustled away, silk skirts trailing in her wake like a silver shadow. Unburdened but still preoccupied, Bria turned and made her way down the gallery. Normally, nothing short of a planet-wide catastrophe could make her neglect her queenly duties. But she felt tired,
tired down to her bones. And normally she would welcome a hectic day to keep her mind off her husband's and daughter's absences. But day after worrying day had ground her down. She had never felt old until recently. Never found it difficult to get out of bed refreshed and energetic. But now she felt her advancing years keenly.
Your Majesty, a minute of your time, if you could...
Her daughter's attendant droid, WA2V, approached from seemingly out of nowhere. The overhead light glinting off her bluish chassis as she darted out from behind a plant in the corridor leading toward the royal apartments. The droid rolled along quickly behind Bria, just a hand's breadth from the train of her gown.
It's just...
The droid hurried on, gears whirring as she struggled to keep up.
Well, the gown of the Equinox is in just 3 weeks, and the Draper really must know if the princess can attend, and if so, if she might prefer silk or satin.
Later, Tuvi, Bria said softly. Ambushed. And here she had hoped to arrive at her chambers alone, granted at last a moment's peace. My appointments are being rescheduled. I'm not to be disturbed.
Majesty!
And now the Minister of Finance running to catch up with them. Peace. It was not to be. Fast on the minister's heels came another shiny chrome head, her daughter's old tutor droid, CZ-70B, clickety-clacking after them on metal feet. That droid was the only one of them that actually had an appointment, and it was probably far too late to cancel that one. Bria did not slow her pace, shrugging off the minister's questions as rapidly as they came. Soon they approached the tall, arched doors leading to the royal apartments, and the two armored sentinels that stood on either side. Through the slits in one enameled helmet, she found the sentinel's eyes and gave the slightest shake of her head.
But your majesty! The gown!
Tuvi sounded ready to pop his servo with frustration.
Step aside, droid! There's hardly a credit in the budget to spare on such ridiculous...
The doors to the royal apartments opened, and with them came a rush of clean, linen-scented air, the sweet sound of her youngest attendant practicing at her lute, and the even more welcoming clank as the halberds of her guards went down behind her, barring entry. Bria stopped just inside the apartment and turned, opening her hands to them as if in surrender. Minister Lintrace and Tuvi stopped short, the tutor droid bumping softly into the girl's back with a muttered apology. Finances, galas, silks, budgets. Would Leia return in time for the equinox? It seemed unlikely, and yet in a small, private corner of her heart that had nothing to do with rebellions or politics, Bria hoped it would be so. Would it mean her success or her failure if she returned that soon? What outcome did she dare wish for? She winced and closed her eyes tightly. It was a mother's duty to worry, but a queen's responsibility to endure. That is enough for today, Bria told them in her firmest voice. She hated the feeling that she was being chased, and hated even more the sense that this was somehow a retreat.
Resources for the gala were allocated months ago, Lintrist, which I'm certain you already know. Tuvi, the draper can pull one of my gowns from storage. The princess may not attend the gala at all, and it would be a waste to begin a new garment from scratch.
The droid hummed with satisfaction, even giving a little turn on her rolling lower half, as if she could not contain her excitement.
Could he at least add a few embellishments here and there? A crystal or two? Perhaps embroidery along the hem?
Walking backward into her apartments, Bria closed her eyes again and suppressed a grin.
Why, yes, Tuvi, that's an excellent idea. I'm certain Leia will be pleased.
Lintrace, by contrast, was not an excitable or easily satisfied attendant. He grimaced and turned with a flounce, his cape swirling behind him as he stalked back down the corridor and away from them. Well, that was one problem taken care of and dispatched, at least.
CZ-7, you may follow,
Bria said, gesturing the droid forward. Then she entered her apartments in earnest, breathing deeply as she stepped through first the antechamber, lush with plants and flowers, then the greeting salon, where her attendant Felina remained bent over her practice, and then through a short, curved corridor that led to their private balcony. Mountain air. There was simply nothing like it for the nerves. Bria closed her eyes against the setting sun. Pink tufts of clouds stretched across the sky, joined by a cascading sunset of orange and deep dark blue. The melting snow off the Duran Mountains shimmered, a promise of warmer months to come. Great migrating groups of Throntas swooping up from the mountains and toward those pink clouds. She smiled and fought the unease in her heart, enjoying as always the sight of those beautiful beasts, gray wings flapping, beating the air as their mournful cries filled the valley. Behind her, her daughter's tutor droid clacked to a stop, and she could hear the soft whir as the droid shifted from foot to foot, waiting.
"Your Majesty,"
the droid began in his clear, automated voice.
"I regret to inform you that I have discovered a grave discrepancy in your daughter's diplomatic records. Ordinarily, this would be simple enough to correct. But with the princess already departed, the error could affect her mission."
Ah, yes. Her mission. Nobody in the palace, of course, save a few key spies and officials, knew exactly where Leia had gone, or why. It was crucial to keep the true reason for her trip a secret. Bria nodded, watching a little iridescent beetle make its way across the balcony banister. It pushed along a tiny tuft of balled-up grass, material for some growing nest. What is the discrepancy? CZ-70B shuffled forward, joining her at the banister. If it was possible for a protocol droid to look nervous, this one accomplished it nearly constantly. Its glowing mechanical eyes darted from side to side, then up and down, and its answer came after a long hesitation. She could all but hear the circuits firing rapidly in the thing's head.
"According to her diplomatic profile, Princess Leia speaks both Hatties and Shriwok fluently. Regretfully, and as your Majesty is keenly aware, the princess is merely proficient in Shriwok. This is, naturally, a failure of mine and not the princess. But I worry that such an error might cause her embarrassment. Oh, it is too humiliating."
Bria allowed herself a smile and turned, putting a motherly hand on the droid's shoulder. "It's hardly your fault that Leia did not apply herself more rigorously." "I wouldn't worry. I'm struggling to imagine a scenario in which fluent Shriwook would benefit her." The droid's eyes flickered brighter, as if in shock. "On this particular mission, of course," the Queen quickly added. Nodding, CZ-70B glanced down at its hands.
"That is perhaps true, Your Majesty, and a relief to hear, but more alarming still is my discovery that...
And here the droid leaned forward, whispering.
"I hesitate to even make this accusation, but the princess altered the record herself."
From behind them came a soft chuckle.
"That does sound like our daughter."
Both Bria and the droid startled in surprise, but it was the Queen who gasped and let her royal demeanor slip for a moment. Her husband had returned, worn perhaps, but as handsome as ever in a well-worn brown cape. She rushed to him, hurling herself gratefully into his open arms. The mountain air of her home was a balm, certainly, but the embrace of her beloved was bliss itself. The war, the rebellion, their daughter's absence, all of it fled from her mind for one single moment. "So long," she whispered, pulling back from him and touching his cheek. "So long."
"And here again," Bail replied, craning down from his height to kiss her. "CZ," he said absently, never taking his eyes off Bria's face. "Go now and fix the record. And know that we are all of us grateful for your particular brand of diligence."
The droid teetered by them, regarding them with wide, bright eyes as it went.
"I only hope my correction does not come too late," It is dreadfully easy to insult a Wookiee.
But Visaya should have told me. Bria's mind reeled. You must have just crossed paths with her, and that damn Andoram, I told him to alert me at once. Bale held her at arm's length as the droid departed, but the smile he gave didn't reach his eyes. Something was deeply wrong. She noticed new lines at his eyes and longer swipes of gray at his temples. And her heart twisted at the thought of all the dangers he had survived to return to that very balcony. She held him tightly again, and then allowed him to lead her to the railing, their hands entwined on the cool marble. A second herd of Srantas soared overhead, their cries echoing off the perimeter of the valley and the heights of the palace.
Don't be cross with either of them, Hart. I told them I wanted this prize to be mine. Stars, but I missed you and this place, he whispered, tilting his head up toward the sky.
Bria wanted desperately to allow herself more time to feel relieved, but her grip on his hand tightened. Scarif, are the rumors true? They couldn't possibly be true. Her husband glanced away from her as he lowered his chin and sighed. He seemed to turn paler, a distant, haunted look coming into his eyes.
You must not think of that now, he assured her.
Their eyes met, and he forced half of a smile.
I had so hoped to make this reunion a happier one. But the news I have...
He trailed off, and for a moment he looked as if he might be sick.
The Senate has been disbanded, she said. We heard days ago, Bale. It's monstrous. I knew the Emperor was bold, but I expected at least a measure of subtlety.
The Senate.
Bale shook his head, his grip on her tightening.
That's not what I must tell you. I thought I knew what I would say, and it's only right that I'm the one to bear the news, but now that it comes to it...
Bria was silent, terrified that if she said another word, he would only falter again. On the railing, she watched the little beetle succumb to a sudden wind, toppling over, all of his hard work lost and scattered. Bale took in a deep breath, and she watched him grow steadier, but still sickly pale. They had known each other for so long, survived so much, but in all their private mythology, never had she seen him look this way. Her husband, a man of unshakable courage and faith, now shaken to his core.
The Tantivy is lost, he whispered. Destroyed.
For a moment, Bria couldn't hear a single thing. Panic. She knew the feeling well, had known it when news of the Senate's dissolution came, but this was something else. This wasn't just panic. It was a perfect, hollow place carving itself out in her chest. A high whine in her head made her deaf to anything but the blood pounding in her ears. She blinked, looking through the face of her husband, through the railing, through the mountains. Then her eyes finally fixed on that beetle, rolling its way across the banister. Bale had fallen to his knees. What little of his strength remained had only lasted until he could deliver that message. It falls to you now. That void in her chest had to be filled with something, or she would collapse inward, a helpless pulsar. Purpose could fill the void, for now at least. Bria folded her hands together, clasping them tighter and tighter, as if that single point of pressure could somehow keep her upright and together.
We must know more than that.
Send another scouting party at once. Escape pods could have been jettisoned. Our daughter is not so easily killed. She will have made every attempt to survive. We need a chart of all planets near that asteroid field. That's where we will begin looking for survivors. And who reported this? Can they be trusted? She demanded, hearing her voice rise until she could control it again. I will not accept any report until I have seen the wreckage with my own eyes.
She nearly demanded to know what exactly the Senate was doing about it. But remember that they were alone in this, lost in an unfamiliar wilderness. Nodding, Bale reached for her, and with shaking hands she helped him from the ground.
I've asked for all that and more, he assured her. We may no longer have the Senate, but we are not without allies. Bria, there is a squadron looking, but we are at war now. You know I would use every possible resource.